power is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's, you know, certainly they're going to do what they're going to do, and it is very frightening. But the only thing that ever speaks to power is when people either stop contributing their labor or their money. And it's frightening, and it means calling their bluff, because the IRS, for all its, you know, thunder, is also underfunded and does not have, you know, enough people to go after everybody. And, you know, I just want to, it's a subject I really think is very relevant as we go into these dark times. And we do, you know, they do want us to feel powerless. But as long as we're giving them money, we're not powerless.
That's right. It's a very good point. And actually, a lot of people are voting to do that. There's upwards of 31 million non-filers right now, people who've chosen not to support the government for various reasons, personal and political. And when you look at that, the numbers like that, and they're growing all the time, I think the system is starting to collapse on itself, and it won't be too much longer before they're just simply going to have abandoned. What I'm concerned about at this point in time is that I suspect that they will come out and say something to the fact that, all right, we've heard your call and decided that the IRS system is much too abusive of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and so forth. So we're going to set up a national sales tax. And by the way, we're also going to abolish money, and everything's going to be on a credit card. That's what I'm suspicious that may be in their background coming up.
They've always got a way of one-upping us.
Yes.
But partly what it's about too, because I do view all of what's going down as spiritual challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if we forget that we are eternal souls, then we are going to be very afraid. If we remember that this is part of our spiritual journey, then we are more likely to accept the challenges and rise to the occasion, because we know we're being tested. Because there's more to come.
Tested to do the right thing. And there's
to do the right thing, but there are spiritual consequences. And people,
that's right.
You know, people, I mean, part of the agenda is to negate our, you know, spiritual consciousness and limit that giving credibility to that reality. But it's true. And for those of us who do choose to remember, it helps us be stronger in making choices that empower ourselves and our communities, rather than, you know, this coming attempt at a new world order. And I'm not convinced they have the power to make it happen, because I really do think, you know, in the 30s, you know, how long did it take information to travel? But here we are, you know, in 2002, and information travels very fast. And there's a lot of people who do know, you know, that the government is not to be trusted, even though the polls are showing otherwise. And the polls are manipulated, and people believe that, too.
Yes, yeah, that's true. It is true, and I'm hoping that the New World Order crowd has grossly underestimated the power of information, the power of the Internet, the power of talk radio and so forth. At least that's what I'm banking on, that they've made a serious error in that regard, and that there is a great deal of hope. As long as we can keep talking, sharing information, I see a great cause for hope that way.
And again, I want to, before I sign off, I want to reiterate the issue about taxation. If we do not like what we are funding, it is our moral duty to stop funding it. We cannot, you know, we cannot protest this, that, or the other about the government one day and the next day send them the money.
And I want you to know that I wrote a letter to Congress, and I said that a very exact same thing.
Well.
And I sent it to every member of Congress twice, two different times.
Thank you.
Cost me a few hundred dollars to do it, but I did it.
So, well, better spent there than in taxes. I hope you can write it off.
That's exactly right. It's where I chose to put my time and money.
And I'm not on the web, but for those who are, I understand the website.
5 seconds.
The website, The Law That Never Was, is an excellent on what's really happening with the IRS.
There we go.
Thank you.
Where does she want to get out?
Oh, she's The Law That Never Was. She was talking about that. That was Theodora Carey.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Tom.
Many times.
Oh yeah, she's very
interesting. She's dedicated, and you know she cares.
You know, she's really come around in recent years. I mean, I've watched her in the last 10 years. She really has come around. She used to be just totally, you know, the full-on liberal.
Mm-hmm.
She really understands now a lot deeper what's going on.
Yeah, we're fortunate to be able to reach a few of the good people here. Good evening, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our colleagues, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, this evening, for this hour, we're going to have with us, once again, our good friend, Myrna Culbraith, who actually created the phonics game and in recent years has created something called Phonicsopoly, which is a game that you play to teach children and to teach young adults and even to teach old people like me about the concept of phonics and how to spell phonetically, to pronounce phonetically, and certainly to read phonetically. And of course, that's the key to good reading, and unfortunately, it's not being taught in our schools very intentionally, and there is a conscious, organized effort to dumb down the American people. Thomas Sowell, the philosopher, the writer from Hoover Institute, one of the senior men up there, has said that if the American people realized what was going on in our educational system, there'd be a revolution. If this was done by a foreign power, it would be considered an attack on the infrastructure of our country. Well, it is being done by a foreign power, not necessarily outside of this country, but by people who are intent upon destroying the United States. And certainly there's nobody who is more knowledgeable on this planned destruction of the minds of our children than Myrna Culbraith. Hi, Myrna, how you doing?
Well, I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, thank you.
You're not an old people. You're one of the youngest people I know. And but it's nice that you've been able to enjoy Phonopoly, too. And it's, you know, I was interviewing Dr. Sowell on the air on your show the other day when I guest hosted for you, and he pointed out that the things like the SAT scores have never been as high as they were in 1963. Even in 1963, there had already been bad effects from the wrong reading method, but it was not quite as profound and widespread as it is since then. And it had started even in the early 1930s, as you know. In fact, in 1929, the Run, Jane, Run books came out. And, you know, the O-O, Look, Look, See, Jane, Run repetition was because they were trying to memorize just a handful of words, like 200 words in all of first grade. Now, this is for kids who walk into first grade as six-year-old children, knowing 24,000 words as spoken words. if you can give them a key to the system where they are able to interpret it and go from the written word and turn it into a talking word, they can read any one of those 24,000 words, and they can learn other words, too. And so if you can do that, they can read Shakespeare, in effect, or a newspaper. And if you don't teach phonics, if you don't teach them how to turn a written word into a talking word, they can't even memorize the 200 words, Dr. Stan. So this has been going on since 1929, and of course it gained momentum from time to time over those years, and it became a horrendous attack, as you're saying, on America. And it was not, you know, it was not just that they put it in, they saw it wasn't working, and they changed it. If they'd done that bad enough, they killed the minds of a few million children over a period of a year or two. But that's not what happened. It went on for 70-something years now, 1929 to 2002, 73 years so far that they've been doing this and doing it wrong and doing it with some deliberation. You know, they wanted to change human nature by taking over the schools, in effect. Then why to change the human nature? To make it fit their politics. And what politics? Well, if you'd ask John Dewey, who was the leader of progressive education and the leading philosopher of education, and the only one that teachers ever hear about, pretty much, if you'd ask him what his politics were, he would have told you socialism. And, you know, he would have called it social system and this and that, but he would have meant socialism. He would have maybe said democratic socialism, meaning that he thought it could be achieved without bloodshed for the most part. But, you know, to achieve it without bloodshed means do it in the schools where you can change the hearts and minds of the children and or sort of wipe the slate clean. So I don't have much in the way of hearts or minds, especially minds. And it's been difficult out there. Now, because this happened, this went on and on and on. It got worse every year. That the last literate generation was the World War II generation. You know, you hear Tom Brokaw saying the greatest generation, which was true, and that generation, luckily we still have some of them around, but they were extremely, extremely literate compared to everybody that has come down the pike since then. In World War II, less than 5%, more like 4%, were illiterate enough that they could not serve in the Army. And it was a decent level of literacy that they were testing then. So only about 4% could not serve. Only 5 years later, World War II ended in 1945, the Korean War started in 1950. The Korean War generation, more than 20% could not read, a 4 to 5 times increase and people who couldn't read, to the point where they thought that the guys were faking it in the Korean War generation. I mean, they hired psychologists and panels and all sorts of people to try to sort out these guys, figuring they're faking it because they don't want to go to war. Well, no, turned out they weren't faking it. They just could not read. Why couldn't they read? Because they'd been taught by the oh, look, look, see Jane Run method. Now, you might have thought, as soon as that alarm bell went off, if no other time, they would certainly have changed what they were doing, knowing they were doing something wrong. No, they knew they were doing something wrong, and they have continued it really until today, except they've made it, if anything, even worse. They used to call it whole word or look say or sight reading or whatnot. Now they mostly call it whole language. And instead of throwing them into the Run, Jane, Run books, where they at least had some theory of how these kids were going to learn to recognize some words, namely just bat them over the head and repeat it often enough. But in the whole language method, you know, it had a controlled vocabulary, it had all that repetition and so on, and you might hope that the kids would at least memorize. In fact, they didn't do too well with it. In whole language, they throw them into the whole English language, into little literature books and little picture books and little this and that, everything in the whole English language, not only up the creek but without a paddle. They don't even give them any way to get hold of this. They read out loud to them while the teacher points to the words on a, quote, big book up at the front of the room. And that's how the kids are supposed to figure out what a word is and which, how to recognize a written word. It's so insane, you know, that as Dr. Sowell said, if parents really knew what was going on, you know, they'd go in and shoot up the joint, probably.
Well, I think that it's so important that people understand that this was done intentionally. It's still being done intentionally. And, of course, they've had a federal panel to investigate reading. And didn't they come to the conclusion, of course, which any logical person would, and that is that the only way to really teach reading is through phonics? And aren't there all sorts of studies, literally hundreds of studies, that demonstrate that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, Dr. Sally Shaywitz, whom we also had when I had her as a guest when I was guest hosting for you last week or so, and she was a member of that National Panel on Reading. She is one of the leading brain researchers in the world. She's located at Yale, and she has been for 20-something years conducting studies on dyslexia what to do about dyslexia and how the brain reads. And lately, last few years, they've had brain scan research where they could look inside the living brain and see what it's doing when it's trying to read. And they have been able to prove, in effect, that the brain reads by phonics. That is to say, it reads by sound. They call it phonological awareness, various other terms like that boils down to the brain reads by phonics. Now, Dr. Sally Shaywitz, I had not fully realized it until I had her on the air, but she was one of the members of that National Panel on Reading that you mentioned. And in the year 2000, they came back with their report. They had been commissioned by Congress, go look at the research on reading and find out what works. Well, we already knew what worked long before that. We've known what worked at least since Why Johnny Can't Read. Most people at least heard the title of that book by Dr. Rudolph Flesch. Most people don't know it came out in 1955. And Dr. Flesch had tripped. Dr. Flesch was a European linguist. He had come over here, gotten his PhD in America, studied the language, and here's the level of scholarship of Dr. Rudolph Flesch long before he wrote Why Johnny Can't Read. He had analyzed how to determine the level of difficulty of a piece of text. And that research is so respected that if you look on your computer, on your desktop today, anybody out there in the audience listening to us, and you go under the Tools menu on Windows, and you go to get a word count, and you'll see a level of difficulty score, and it'll say Flesch or Flesch Kincaid grade level. That's Dr. Rudolph Flesch, the man who wrote Why Johnny Can't Read. So that's the level of his scholarship. And he said in Why Johnny Can't Read, and he went and he used his research skills and explained how he did it. But, you know, if you go into a library and you check the most recent research on something, it'll refer to the earlier research and that to the earlier research, and you can track down in a matter of short time all of the research on a topic, especially back in 1955. It's a little harder today when there are more studies, but the conclusion is still the same. And he said, I will stake my reputation as a researcher that all of the scientific research ever done on how to teach reading shows that any kind of phonics is better than any kind of whole word, and not just a little bit, but no comparison. And then he went through each of the studies that existed at that time and went over what it actually showed. Sometimes you had to make your own analysis and reading of the research, because if you read the summary, it said, oh, gee, we've proved the Lexay is good. If you read what they actually did, you saw that their actual results supported phonics. So he went through, he did that process. About 10, 11 years later, Dr. Gene Child did a similar analysis. Except now there was still more research, and she was more of an insider. She was a professor of education. She had a Carnegie grant to go study what works in reading. It was thought she would come back and say, oh, gee, yes, looks say, good stuff. And as a matter of fact, she came back with exactly the same conclusion as Flesch, that what she called a code emphasis, she meant phonics. Anything that teaches you to break down the alphabetic code and turn a written word into a talking word. Any kind of code emphasis is better than any kind of, she called, look, say, meaning emphasis. And again, no comparison.
Well, you know, I think that the tragedy is that the American people really don't know that they are attacking the minds of our children, that their children are simply being used as guinea pigs in a vast social experiment, and that our educational system has nothing to do with education, it has to do with indoctrination, and that they're really not interested in reading, writing, and arithmetic. They're interested in changing the outlook of our children towards God and family and country. And the fact that Christian churches are not telling their parishioners to get their kids out of the government schools. They're not actively making every church in America a school. The fact that our ministers are willing to sacrifice the children of this country on the altar of political expediency because they don't want to offend anybody who might be working in a public school. I know that most public school teachers, or the majority of them in many areas, don't send their children to public schools because they know they don't stand a chance. They send their children to private schools. Certainly, we don't see our congressmen sending their children to public schools. And yet, of course, the great tragedy is that so many good Christian children go to public schools, government schools. They get indoctrinated in all these crazy ideas. They're turned against God. They're taught there is no God. They're turned against their family. They're told, you know, they're trying to discipline you, and you've got to learn to make mature decisions for yourself based upon your feelings. And, of course, as far as country is concerned, so many of our young people come out of schools dedicated internationalists, knowing everything wrong with America and nothing right about America. And our plea, of course, to our listeners is get your children, get your grandchildren out of government schools. There are ways to do it. We do carry through our ministry the Phonopoly or Phonixopoly program, which Myrna has developed. We carry the Robinson homeschool curriculum. There are many other good homeschool curriculums out there. We just happen to like this one very much. But we hope that if you are listening to this program, you'll understand that they're out to get the souls of our children, and they're doing a great job, which is why so many young people are into drugs and sexual promiscuity. This is the end result of what they've learned in the government schools. And as far as their ability to read is concerned, how many children do we have out there now on Ritalin? Many of them because they just can't read, and they then are they fidget in class, they don't get along in class, they can't pay attention in class. We call them ADH or ADHD. How many children do we have on drugs?
It's around 7 to 8 million now, as far as the best figures I can find. And again, we had Peter Bragan,
right,
on your show the other a few days ago, and he's the leading anti-psychiatric drug expert in the country. He's that kind of expert because he went to college, and while he was there, he volunteered in a mental hospital. He actually became the head of a program for college students to go volunteer in a mental hospital. These were people on the back wards and in terrible shape. And instead of giving them drugs, these college students went in and talked with them and gave them support and help and emotional caring and whatnot. They were able to get most of them back out of the mental hospital, whereas the people that were giving them drugs, of course, were condemning them forever. Well, he since became an advocate against surgery, psychosurgery to change people's brains, and drugs to change people's brains, and beginning with things like Prozac and the antidepressants and whatnot. He wrote a book called Talking Back to Prozac, and then a bunch of others, Talking Back to Ritalin, and now he's got the Ritalin Factbook. Well, anyway, he has determined that, first of all, there's pretty much no such thing as ADHD. Whatever there is caused by things like failure to teach the kids to read is one of the leading causes. And if you drug the kid, not only does it not do any good, not only is there not any evidence that giving Ritalin actually improves things, but the effects of Ritalin, even the effects that are considered beneficial, never mind the ones that are considered harmful, even the ones that are considered beneficial are harmful. Namely, it subdues the child. If you give it to an animal, it makes the animal stop exploring, socializing, relating to things, and it often gives them robot-like behavior where they sit there and repetitively groom themselves or chew on the cage or whatnot. And, you know, if it'll do that to an animal, it does it to the child, too. It subdues the spontaneous behavior, the thinking behavior, that you want in a child. And yeah, it makes it maybe easier to manage for the teacher in the government school, but it's your kid. And there is no beneficial effect from Ritalin, and it's extremely dangerous. It's cross-addicting to all of the other street drugs. It has effects virtually identical to the effects of cocaine. It is, in effect, another form of cocaine, you could call it. And this is going on in the schools because, again, they haven't taught them to read, so now they're savages. And, you know, the kids, how are the kids going to pay attention? Because they don't know which word is which or how to figure it out. They could have been taught 40 sounds and a handful of rules, and wham, they're down the road, and they can turn any written word into a talking word, and their brains look reasonable when you look into them. If you look into the brain of somebody who's been taught by sight reading, it looks confused, it looks jangled, it looks like it's using the wrong half of the brain. It should be using the language side of the brain, the talking side of the brain, which is the left side. Teaching sight reading as if the words were pictures probably sends it to the picture recognition part of the brain, which is in the right half. Also turns out the right half doesn't even speak English.
These are PET scans that they're using. How are they looking into the brain?
Yeah, PET scans, right. and MRI scans and so forth. And we had Dr. Sally Shaywitz, who's doing that. We had Dr. Guinevere Eden on one of your programs a week or so ago. She's also another leading researcher on dyslexia and what's going on in the brain. Her research, hers, and she has a husband who also is in the same area of research. Some of her research showed if you looked into the brain of a kid and you saw this jangled effect of not being able to figure out what's going on, and then you had the kid taught phonics by a half-reasonable method, you know, not quite as neat a method as phonics softly, but nonetheless phonics, it changed how the brain looked. The brain looked, in effect, much better, and you could see that the brain was reading by sounds, in effect. Now you can actually, you know, I've been arguing some of this for many years, Dr. Sam, that if you're teaching the wrong method, you're probably teaching it to the wrong half of the brain and setting people up to have to go back and forth from both sides of the brain in order to work this out. And by the way, women have a little better shot at going back and forth than men do, just physiologically. The main connector between the two halves of the brain, the corpus callosum, is physically bigger in females. Well, it turns out, if you teach reading by phonics, everybody learns it equally well, men, women, boys, girls. If you teach it by sight reading, somewhere around 9 out of 10, minimum 3 out of 4, worst-case victims are boys and men. You know, I was telling you, I think, a different time, Dr. Stan, that if I say this in front of a seminar full of enough men that I can afford to pick on them, I say, you know, well, you guys were a little bit defective. But, you know, it's probably just a difference that is, you know, speculating. Maybe the woman had to be there with the kids and the cave bear and the fire and whatnot, and if she didn't pay attention to six different things at once, the kids fell in the fire, and that was the end of that gene pool. And maybe the man needed to be single-tracked out on the hunt and be able to stay in the left side of the brain for long periods of time. So it's different, but it's equal if you teach reading the right way. If you don't, you know, men are an endangered species these days. Little boys, you know, there was a reason why Dr. Flesch said why Johnny can't read, apart from the fact that he tripped over an actual Johnny, 12-year-old son of a friend of his. But there wasn't a Janie to correspond, and there were Janies that were hurt. They just weren't hurt quite as badly.
And I think it was really so interesting that it's mostly boys that are on Ritalin that have this ADHD phenomenon.
That's true, it's about 7 to 1.
This made-up diagnosis. You have to have a made-up diagnosis, because if you're going to bill as a psychiatrist, you have to have a number. And so they made up ADHD, and they, you know, and some kids fidget, they don't pay attention. That's just part of being a kid. But, of course, if you can't read, it's ever so much worse. And so many of these children, their problem is not anything more than they can't read. Now, there's some children who are type A personalities. They're just going all the time. But the last thing you want to do is take this child that has this wonderful ability to be so inquisitive and wanting to learn and wanting to talk and do all these things and begin to drug him in the schools. And, of course, it's even worse if he really can't read. He can't accomplish what he's supposed to because of this intentional program of dumbing down our children. Ladies and gentlemen, this is unconscionable, and yet it's going on today. And our children are the victims. And if you are a parent out there or a grandparent, you better understand that what Myrna is saying is absolutely true. And we've interviewed Dr. Peter Bragan a number of times. We carry his book, Talking Back to Ritalin. We even talk, I have a four-tape set we put together on Ritalin and how they're drugging and damaging our children, not only their minds, but their bodies, because Ritalin has a suppressory action or suppresses the pituitary. And there's so much evidence out there, the deleterious effects. And we're using it not in spite of that, but I personally believe, at least in some cases, because of that, because we're dealing with evil people. And when you understand that, all this makes sense. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense at all. Well, if you're out there across America or up there in the great state of Washington, northern Oregon, western Idaho, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you're here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 464-8295. And you have to understand there are people who look at the world differently than you and I. There are people who are not concerned about human suffering. They are callous and indifferent to it. They have a political agenda. And of course, the man who is primarily involved in this whole effort to introduce the look-see type of reading was a man named John Dewey. And John Dewey was a dedicated socialist. He thought communism was wonderful. He had been to Russia. He thought that we should have this society every place. And you have to understand that this is an elitist concept. Dewey wanted to be one of the leaders. He was actually eventually at Columbia University, and he taught the teachers who taught the teachers, Columbia being the premier university for our education. And here's where you're professors to be went to get their education. And we have a problem today in that most teachers don't know how to teach phonics because they don't know how to read themselves. Would that be a fair statement, Myrna?
That's a fair statement. And the National Panel on Reading report concluded, and the USA Today reported on it, that conclusion, for example, only 10% of teachers know how to teach phonics, grade school teachers. And I'd say that's a high estimate in that even the ones who think they know how to teach phonics know just a fraction of what we include in the first three games of Phonicsopoly. If you ask them a question from the third game, they don't know it. Even when they think they believe in phonics, even when they are trying to teach phonics, even when they're people of half-decent will and would like to teach phonics, what they know is very limited. And then the rest of them don't even know and don't pretend to know even that much, and some are hostile to phonics because they've been educated in the teachers' colleges. And as you said, Dewey and his bunch of progressive educators in effect became education in this country. They took over the teachers' colleges. Teachers' College, Columbia University, was sort of the be-all and end-all of education. The graduate students went out from there and from Dewey's old department at Chicago University and from other places. Dewey's mentor was a man named G. Stanley Hall, and one of his other proteges was a man named Huey, who wrote a book on the whole word method. He wrote it in 1908. This was after Dewey already knew in 1897, that it didn't work. So over 100 years ago, Dewey even admitted that his method did not work. He said, "We do not claim that by the new method the children will learn to read as early or as well as by the old method, but we want to use it anyway," in effect, which if you think about it, is one of the more evil things you can say in the English language. And he then promoted it from there on out. 1908, there was Dewey, then there was Huey. I never did figure out where was Louie. But these guys took over education. They put in the whole word method, even though they knew by then that it caused guessing. Huey wrote in his book that if a child guesses pony instead of horse, well, that's an encouraging sign that the reading is real. Well, no, it's not. It's a sign that the kid can't get the right word off the page. He might be bright enough to figure it out. It has something to do with a pony or horse if there's a picture on the page, but it's still guessing, and it's not reading. Whereas if you teach the sounds within a few weeks of first grade have kids reading. What parents don't know now, because it's been going on for so long, is what is normal? Well, normal is you go to school in the fall in the first grade. You could do it in kindergarten, too, if you wanted to. But at least by first grade, go to school in the fall. By Christmas, you can read if they're teaching phonics. By spring, if not sooner, you can read a newspaper or essentially anything printed in the English language. And on any half-reasonable subject, the kid will understand it. So that's what normal is, and that sounds like it arrived from Mars if you talk to a parent now. What, my first grader should be able to read a newspaper? That's crazy.
Well, let's just see what Ron, we're going to have to get Ron to hold on through the break. Ron, can you hold on through the break?
Oh, yeah, that's okay.
Okay, fine. Well, we'll be right back here in just a moment. When we get back, of course, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there listening to us across America, we hope that you'll want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day, bringing the information you're not going to get from many other sources, and pointing out the spiritual nature of the battle in which we're engaged. So if you'd like to know more about our ministry, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV. Or now, if you'd like to find out about phonopoly or phonixopoly, as it's called, you can call that same number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-544-8927, and, of course, get some information. This is an excellent product. I've used it myself, and I will have to admit that I've always been a very poor speller, but I have improved dramatically, and I'm in my 70s. So anybody can learn from using this. This is fun for children. It's fun for young people, and it's even fun for old folks. So, again, if you'd like to know more about phonopoly or phonixopoly, the number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Then I want to mention, of course, that we are putting on a seminar, an all-day seminar at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. It's going to be this coming Saturday, and we have we have over 100 people coming now. We have to actually cut this off tomorrow evening. We need to know if you'd like to come. You'll have to give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And we're going to be talking about what's coming down the line, the plans that were laid out in Johannesburg by the people who rule the world. And Joan Parris was actually there. And, of course, we'll have her wisdom. We'll have Brad Dacus talking to us about what's happening as far as the anti-Christian, the bigotry that exists in this country today, and, of course, how this thing is being handled by the courts. Right present day is, of course, quite favorable to Christians, but the time will come when I'm sure that that will change. And then Bill Sardi will be there talking on health issues, Jeannie Soderman, about how this whole thing ties together with the Earth Charter, the plan to use the water. You pick up the newspaper any day, listen to the media. Well, there's a great deal of talk about the water shortage. Oh, terrible water shortage. We're running out of water. And if you believe that, you probably believe anything. But they have managed to complicate things when we have people focused in certain areas, and then you effectively block efforts to put in dams or reservoirs to hold back saltwater intrusion. They create the problem, but they have a solution.
They
control the water, they control you. And that is the big problem we have today. So then, of course, I'll be talking on preparation, because we're facing some very, very difficult times financially. And if you don't understand the history of our monetary system, you're certainly not going to know what to do at these times. And I'll tell you what, in countries like Argentina, which a year ago was a prosperous country. Today, half the people are living in abject poverty. They wiped out the middle class there. The people who believed what the government told them, that they would never devalue the peso, that it was tied to the dollar, and the dollar was as good as gold. Well, once again, they lied, but this is what governments do. They don't tell the truth. And, of course, we're going to talk to you about preparation fiscally, financially, from a spiritual point of view. So we hope that many of you will give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and that you'll be coming to this all-day-long conference at the Aptos Seascape Center. Give us a call before evening tomorrow if you're going to come, and we look forward to seeing you there. Doors will open at 8, they'll close at 6. It'll be a good day, and we'll be right back here with our special guest, Myrna Culbreth. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and just again, that telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We've got Ron calling from Spokane. Ron, did you have a question or comment?
Well, sort of a comment. Now, I heard either you or the host mention that kids by nature will want to discover the world, socialize, they're inquisitive, and, you know, on and on. Now, I consider good kids probably either sick or retarded. I like ones that are full of mischief. Now, a single mother, see, once the government got rid of the fathers, the mother couldn't stand a kid that won't just sit there and watch TV all day. That's why they give them Ritalin. I really believe that.
Well, I think that, of course, in the classroom, it's really what's being encouraged, and they don't want the child that's inquisitive, that's fidgeting, just doesn't want to sit there quietly. And it's the schools that are pushing Ritalin on our children, and they're telling parents, if you don't do it, you know why, we can go to the Child Protection Agency. Your child
right.
needs to be on Ritalin, and if you don't give it, why, we're just going to have to report you as a bad parent. And I'll tell you what. There are people who have lost their children over this. There are even doctors who have lost their license because they wanted to take children off of this. A terrible drug. This is a controlled substance. You can't buy this over the counter. It's an addictive substance, and we're giving it to, you know, 4, 5, 6, 8 million children. What madness is this? Anything else you want to say, Ron?
No, that's it.
God bless you. Thanks so much for calling.
Ritalin is artificial cocaine.
You're absolutely right.
You're right.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye. And thank you, and let's go to Bob calling in from Alabama. Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
Yes, Dr. Stan. Good to talk to you. I have a question about the phonics thing. How does that tie into Chinese characters, Japanese characters?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question, but I'm not going to answer that. I'm going to let you talk to Myrna because she understands, and this is really the key to what this is all about. Can you answer Bob's question? How does it tie into the Chinese and Japanese language, which are figures?
Yeah, in effect, what they're doing when they're trying to teach it wrong is they're teaching English as if it were Chinese, as if you had to memorize each separate symbol. And Chinese is, in effect, a picture language. That is, you know, it's very stylized, but initially those little graphic things were a picture. A man is sort of like a stick figure you draw, except leaving off the head and the arms, and that's the word for man in Chinese and so forth. And a river is three wavy lines and so on. So originally they were pictures. And you had to memorize. And there's not a key to the system in Chinese. There's a few ways they try to simplify it, but fundamentally it is not a phonetic language and therefore very tough to learn. Now, Japanese has both that kind of symbol and it has a syllable-based kind of phonics called kanji, which, you know, is helpful. At least the Japanese can learn that more easily. It's very tough to learn a picture language. In China, they have different levels of newspaper that you can read if you've memorized a couple thousand of those characters, and another one you can read if you've memorized 5 or 7 thousand, and it's the way that they keep classes divided in effect. So, very tough to learn Chinese, and the great thing about English is it's a phonetic language, and the Phoenicians figured this out a long time ago. They said, let's take some of these little pictures that were Egyptian hieroglyphics and let them stand for sounds that we make when we talk. Somehow they figured there are not very many different sounds. There are an awful lot of different words. And it took 20 years in a temple school to even reasonably halfway learn Egyptian hieroglyphics. And it took your whole lifetime. And you had to be one of out of maybe 1,000 people to even attempt it. And it's very tough. Well, the Phoenicians were sort of a capitalist of the ancient world. They lived where Israel is now. They wanted to send ships all over the world. They needed to be able to teach a dock hand to check off of a bill of lading or read an invoice, and they didn't need to do it yesterday. And they figured out a way, and the way was phonics. Take a few of those pictures, about 20 of them, let them stand for sounds. As soon as you teach somebody which pictures stand for what sounds, he can write down any word that he can say. He can read back a word that you write, and you're in business, and he's learned to read, and you'll be able to read forever. We, in our infinite wisdom, threw out that invention of the Phoenicians, which took over the world because it was such a good invention. It overwhelmed all other kinds of writing except Chinese and Japanese to a certain extent. And it worked for everybody. It worked for 3,000 years, and we, in 1930, threw it away.
And does that answer your question, Bob?
Well, yes, in a way, but I'm wondering about in China, what percentage of the people are the low-grade readers, and how many have the memory capability to get to the very high reading?
I don't know the real answer to that. I know that, for example, I asked that kind of question of a well-educated Chinese doctor one time. How many words are there, and how many does the average person memorize and whatnot? He said a very educated person such as myself might know about 7,000 Chinese characters. Altogether, there are only about 14,000. Now, this is in contrast to English, which has 1 million words or more. And so he said an educated person such as himself might have memorized 7,000. He said there was a newspaper that you could read if you'd memorized a couple thousand. How many were able to do which one, I don't exactly know.
Okay, anything else, Bob?
No, that's fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Thanks Bye-bye. For calling. And, of course, I think that Bob's question, it really is so important. People have to understand that, you know, one reason our society prospered is because we had a literate society, and anybody could learn to read. In 1800, we had a 95% literacy rate. Myrna was saying that at the time of the Second World War, we had... in 1800, we had a 95% literacy rate. In 1941, we had a 95% literacy rate. And according to the Department of Health and Education and Welfare, today we have close to 100 million illiterate or partially illiterate Americans. Now, that didn't happen by accident. And it's about time the American people understood. We've been under attack for a long time, and what's going on in Washington, D.C. today, when they say no child left behind, what they really mean is no child is going to get a good education. Everybody's going to be educated and programmed into what the government wants you to. Certain children will be selected to go on to college. Others will be selected for trades. We are going to have a perfectly organized society just like they have in Russia and China. That is, if we allow them to get away with it. They have their agenda. We have to understand that behind everything going on, there are spiritual forces that do not want man to be free, but want to control us from the cradle to the grave. And what we are doing is implementing exactly what Plato wrote about 350 years before Christ was born in Bethlehem. Society he envisioned where you would have a philosopher king, a ruling oligarchy, a massive military and police force that would control the populace, and then everything else would be controlled. There would be no families. All women would belong to all men. The children would belong to the state. And believe me, there are people working in the Child Abuse and Child Protection Agency today who believe children belong to the state. Don't you dare discipline your child. Don't you dare shake your child in public. Don't you dare do anything to your child, or we're going to take it away from you. You say that couldn't happen? Ladies and gentlemen, it is happening all across America today. And, of course, they're drugging our children. But we have to, actually, God gave the children to parents, not to the government. And we have to proclaim that over and over and over again. And, of course, what we have to do is educate people what's going on, get our children out of the government schools, and say what you will about the necessity to socialize. Let me tell you, look at the children who've been homeschooled and look at the children who've been schooled in the government schools. They're entirely different children. And I will tell you that the children who are homeschooled are disciplined, they're orderly, they're polite, and the rest of the children, well, it's just an entirely different attitude that they have. And, of course, they lose their respect for God, family, and country. You can't let that happen. We've got to get our kids out of the government schools. So, Marla, do you think that certainly are people beginning to understand what is going on across America? Do you think more and more parents are becoming concerned about the failed educational system we have in America that's given us some of the lowest SAT scores in the entire world?
I do think that, Dr. Stan. I know that the Wall Street Journal reported on a study which said that 85% of parents believe that phonics is the solution of the reading crisis. So, you know, 85% of Americans, you can't get agreement on whether the sun will come up with that, but they agree that phonics is the solution. If they know that much, they know a lot. And yet, no matter how much they hammer, they cannot seem to get this through anybody's head. And the reason is the underlying philosophical resistance that we've talked about. What I think parents and grandparents have to realize is, as you're saying, if you can, get them out of the schools. If you don't think you can, or it's not, doesn't seem to be feasible, well, you may want to rethink that. But at least what you could do is you could get phonopoly, get phonicsopoly, and teach them to read. You know, it's a good time for this now. It happens to be coming up on Christmas time. If you're not going to do it before then, you might grab it and do it before then, because any day the kid spends in school without good reading is really a torture day. But if you want a Christmas present that'll change the lives of an entire family, you could do a lot worse than think about phonopoly, and especially the way
no, we can't
you
talk
offer
about
people.
How we're offering it on this program, but certainly I hope that people will want to get more information on this, and I certainly agree with you. I think it's an excellent gift for children and for grandchildren. The greatest gift you can give to a child is the ability to read.
That's right, and you know, then you can, you know, even if people don't want to go all the way to homeschooling, or they sort of need the babysitting effective schools, you may want to rethink that too, but at least you could do something like getting phonicsopoly, getting the homeschool program, which comes on a whole bunch of computer disks, I understand, and it takes you all the way through school. You could use that for testing, for supplementation, for teaching the content of this great culture. You know, they're not teaching. You know, when you went to school, parents or grandparents, maybe they taught you some nice, decent history. I was talking to somebody today who was just getting phonicsopoly, and she said, you know, when I went to school, they taught us some history. I knew, you know, who the founding fathers were. I knew a lot of things, and now I listen to Jay Leno, and he's asking college students and graduate students, and they don't know, you know, who made the first flag, and they don't know who carried out the revolution, and they don't know even, you know,
We heard the other night, one of the questions was, who wrote Handel's Messiah? And nobody could figure it out. I said to my wife, these people have to be plants. These could not be, educated human beings. And her reply was, look, they go out on the street and they get these children. And, of course, after a few answers, why they recruit them to come on the program. And they're not professional actors. They're the end product of an educational system that has failed, and you destroy the education of our children, of course, you destroy the nation. And that's exactly what they're doing. They know exactly what they're doing. I mean, other children there, you know, had no idea where Egypt was. There were children there that had no idea, you know, anything about the Constitution, the foundation of this country. It was just, you know, they had no idea what who the Pilgrims were. You wonder how they could do such a poor job unintentionally, and then you suddenly realize that it wasn't unintentional. It was intentional, and they are really very, very successful. They just don't want the American people to know that.
Yeah, Dr. Sowell, when we had him on the program the other day, I asked him how could they be doing this so badly, in effect, and he said, you know, when people ask me that, I ask them, why doesn't Tiger Woods score more touchdowns?
And he said, you know, it's not the game that they're playing. To get good results, to teach good educational results, that's not the game that educators are playing. You think they're playing golf, they're really playing take over the world. And that's why which I thought was a pretty good analogy. If you ask why didn't Tiger Woods score more touchdowns, you may realize that is not the game they are playing. What you want the kids to be doing in school is not what the educators are doing.
Well,
and if you don't like it, you better do something else.
Well, of course, the thing is, the average teacher really is not part of this. The average teacher, I think, is really well-motivated, but the people who run the educational establishment, the administrators, certainly the people in the National Education Association, they understand what it's all about, and they're certainly going to keep the teachers in the dark. And then when anybody challenges the educational system, and I've been at their meetings, they will say, look, these people criticizing us, we're trying to do such a good job. It's us against them, you know. Which side are you going to be? Are you going to be a traitor to your profession, or are you going to support those of us who, you know, are here to educate the children? Or what they should say is dumb down the children, but they're not going to admit that. And so the average teacher is caught in a system not of their own making. And since they've never been taught phonics and they really don't understand this, all they do is they go to these meetings they're required to go to that tells them, you know, what the problem is not the fact that we're teaching the children incorrectly or we're not teaching them at all. What we need is more money and smaller class size. You could have, two students in a class, and if you were not teaching them phonics, these kids still couldn't read.
That's right, and the class size thing is just a convenience for teachers, basically, and there's no clear-cut evidence that smaller classes actually do anything, and as you say, you could have it as small as you like. You don't teach phonics, you're still in big trouble, and they do. I happened to be at a meeting recently, and it was a major educational meeting, a whole bunch of educators there, and a speaker was speaking about what they were going to do for education, and I got up and asked a question from the audience. Now, here's an audience packed with teachers and teachers' unity. And as you say, an ordinary teacher is generally a person of pretty good will, but by the time she or he gets institutionalized into the system, their dues go to support one of the largest and most powerful, the most largest and most powerful political lobby in the country. The National Education Association, in effect, controls the Democratic Party, as was shown by an independent commission lately. And so by the time you get these teachers into a herd, they have been taught that reading is some vast, horrible, complicated process. You couldn't possibly teach it except over a period of years, and even then you're going to have failures, and then you got to drug them. And so they've been taught all of this. Well, I got up in this gathering, and I said to the speaker, you know, we have had a study of phonicsopoly under U.S. Department of Education grant, worst-case kids, disadvantaged kids, poor kids, second-language kids, mostly minority kids, and phonicsopoly took them from the bottom 25% to the top 14% in the country in 16 hours. Now, suppose that what I'm saying to you is true, or that I could establish to you that it's true. What could you suggest for getting this out to the rest of the country? Well, when I first introduced myself, I said I'm the author of the Phonics Game, which has gone out to about 1 million users, and now the new Phonicsopoly, and this is the result, top 14% in the country. If that's true, what could you do to get it out to the country? The audience broke out in jeering laughter, the audience of teachers and administrators. As if, here's a person from Mars. She couldn't possibly know how complicated it is to teach reading, what it means, 16 hours. It got to be a lie, got to be ridiculous, etc. That was the mode in the congregation of teachers and mainly administrators. And then the speaker came back and said, well, you know, of course you've got to take a, quote, balanced approach.
Right, and of course a balanced approach does nothing but confuse the child and confuse the mind. Let's go to Kurt calling in from Santa Cruz. Hi, Kurt, how are you doing?
Hello, fine. It's not just reading. I mean, I have a standard test I give on history and the first six presidents or whatever, and see, you know, to show parents how much their kids don't know. But I'm a music teacher. I've been teaching almost 40 years now. I started teaching at 15 years old. It is normal in my studios to teach kids to start teaching at 15. We have a lot of kids. We've had them as young as 12 teaching, you know, vice presidents of Silicon Valley companies. And they look over and they go, the kid knows what he's doing. And I go, of course. When you teach correctly, that happens. Now, it is normal. I'll use saxophone as an example. It is normal for fifth graders in our studios, even taught by some of the teenage teachers that I've trained, it is normal for them to be reading opera arias by a contemporary of Mozart in as little as 16 weeks. As a matter of fact, it's normal in 16 weeks, sometimes a little sooner. That's 5.5 months, 10 and 11-year-old kids reading well or perfectly opera arias that would normally be an etude book used in the freshman year of college in a music major. Now, I've taught in a couple colleges, and I couldn't get my freshmen to learn the same pieces well in half a year. But if we start them at the beginning and we start them correctly, the kids learn marvelously well.
Yeah, you know, these kids are so smart, they learn a foreign language in a very, very short period of time. But you've got to start training them, and it's when they're very young that they have that marvelous attentiveness and capacity to remember.
Oh, God makes these marvelous little bundles that just love to learn. I mean, they enthuse it. That's the fun. That's the play, is learning. And yet, what we see in the schools, there's a method we use when I train band directors that was written in 1939 that works remarkably well. Most of the new methods don't work at all. I have seen schools with a 20% or a 30% retention rate at the end of the year. Now, nationwide, it's 52%. But in this area, I've frequently seen schools at 20 and 30, and I've even seen them at zero. Now, with a teacher that I trained to teach correctly, who was a college freshman doing this as a class project, paid by the PTA, the Band Boosters, the thing is, that teacher had a 92% retention rate in her first year, 19 years old, with 75 kids.
Okay, well, that's great, Kurt. We're out of time, but thanks so very much for sharing that with us.
It's in all areas of education.
Right, and if we were educating them right, the kids would remember more. God bless
right.
you.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye now.
Okay, fine. Well, Myrna, we're just about out of time. That was Kurt, and he's certainly one of our supporters living here, and you know, and I think he's demonstrating what you and I both know, and that is that children have an amazing capacity to learn.
Well, I'm talking about using...
It's very hard to dumb them down, but they've accomplished it.
I'm afraid so. And using teenagers to do it, we've done that. That was in that phonicsopoly study, too. Those kids were mostly taught by teenagers that were taught phonicsopoly.
Right. Well, what is the parting thought you'd like to leave with our listeners
this
evening?
Well, I'd say, you know, don't leave this to anybody else. If you're listening to our voice, you have anything to do with a kid or with a product of the educational system that's not a kid. Maybe it's your grown child or your grown, you know, grandmother. For that matter, because it's been going on for a long time, how about getting a series of games that's as much fun to play as Monopoly and plays a little bit like Monopoly, as you might guess, and yet it's got the whole logic behind the English language. It goes on up to the level of everything you always wanted to say but were afraid to pronounce, even foreign expressions. But it meanwhile teaches you the entire logic. Why not do that? Why not do it for yourself for this Christmas? You know, who's sitting on you? Nobody is holding you down. It's not that difficult. It's not that complicated. It's not even that expensive. And, whammo, you can solve the whole problem. And if you just teach reading, you have armored somebody against much of what's wrong in the schools. Not everything, but at least the most critical things.
Well, God bless you, and I agree with you totally. Thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, it's always a delight, Dr. Stanton. Thank you for having me.
Right. Good night. God bless you. Well, this is Myrna Culbraith, and we're certainly talking about the reading problems, and of course she's devised an excellent program. It's called Phonicsopoly or Phonopoly. I have to teach reading, and so we're going to have to say goodbye to our listeners up there in the Great Northwest, and ask you, of course, to pray for our country, to pray for revival in our country, because if our people don't turn back to God, God will turn against this country forever. And then, of course, to pray for our leaders, to pray for our ministers, but lastly, to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, we'll be back with you again. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us Mr. Matt Throckmorton, and Mr. Throckmorton is actually a member of the legislature in the great state, I believe, of Utah. But we're going to be talking this evening about the child protection agencies and, of course, how the federal government is involved in setting policies for local child protection agencies and the gross miscarriages of justice, the real problems that develop because of federal interference in parents' relationship to their child, and of course the pressure that's put on local communities to go along with federal guidelines. Matt, thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, why don't you tell us just a little bit about your concern over this? Now, you are a member of the state legislature?
Correct. And I actually chair a committee up in the Utah legislature that oversees child protective services for the state of Utah. So it's an issue that I've dealt with for a whole bunch of years. And in Utah, we've been grappling with the issue of child protective services, and it's a balancing act. You have to protect abused children. But then if the state goes too far, then suddenly you have a problem of abused families. And we've had an awful lot of really good reforms in the state of Utah, everything from tracking psychological drugs to requiring a warrant before a child is removed. What we've ran into in the last year, though, is federal law. And it's federal funding, actually. The federal government everywhere, they seem to, they take your money, first of all, and then they tell the states, if you want the money back, it's pretty simple. You just have to do what we have to do, or what we tell you. And federal law right now with Title IV-E contracts, they require the states to remove children in order to receive federal funding, and it's just causing fits.
Well, no, by remove children, you mean under what guise, under what auspices, how can they remove children? What are the requirements to remove children?
Well, every state's requirements will be a little bit different, but it's generally under terms of neglect or abuse. And it could be everything from medical neglect, educational neglect. Abuse could be everything from spanking a child to yelling at a child, things of that nature, having an argument in front of a child.
Well, I'll tell you what, I mean, if you don't yell at children, sometimes they don't hear you. If you don't spank the child, you're violating God's requirement, spare the rod and spoil the child. Sometimes you have to get a child's attention.
Yeah, in Utah, it was a case up until a couple of years ago. I ran a bill on it. In other states, you'd periodically hear stories of somebody that they give their child a smack or something, and they'd be criminally charged for felony child abuse. And in Utah, that wasn't the case. You'd never get charged. What would happen is they would show up and they'd remove your child and they'd say it's abuse. And so instead of going the criminal route, they'd go the civil route and remove the child. And
But what are they going to do, put in a foster home where they may be sexually abused or, you know, in with homosexuals? Or, you know, once you break the family up, you destroy the cohesiveness, and that parent loses complete control of that child forever.
What we have managed in the state of Utah to do when it comes to the removal, we put into law something that's called kinship. It requires by law that when the state removes the child, the first area that they look for placement of that child is with family. And it could be grandparents, aunt, uncle, brother, sister, cousins, whatever it may be. The family can give a list to the state agency, DCFS, 20 or 30 people long, and say, here are individuals that are directly involved with this child, and I'd like the child to go there, and then prioritize them. And it's actually worked out really well.
Well, now, of course, will you actually take a child away from a parent because they spanked them?
Well, we've gotten away from doing that in the state of Utah, but, boy, I no longer tell horror stories. When I first got into this, I would tell horror stories. you know, a case of a child being, three children being removed because of a Christmas tree that was 18 inches tall and it was neglect. The mother, the single mother, was failing to provide to societal standards for Christmas. You know, I've stopped telling the horror stories because, frankly, people don't believe them. And, you know, we have...
They took the children away because the Christmas tree was too small.
That was in their, that was in the initial complaint. In Utah, and I imagine it's very similar in most states, once they remove a child, they have a certain time frame in which they go before a judge, the first real hearing, and it's called a shelter hearing. And at the 72-hour shelter hearing they had on the complaint there, one of the evidences of neglect was they only had a few presents under this little 18-inch Christmas tree. But, you know, I've stopped telling the horror stories because you tell them and people just quite honestly, they don't believe you. In fact, I had one legislator who was my antagonist. Everything I did, this legislator would just fight me tooth and nail. And then a good personal friend of the family of hers, she had known him for 20 to 30 years, they ran into this headlong, and she was just amazed. She saw it firsthand, and now she's become a tepid supporter. But she has dramatically changed, this legislator has dramatically changed their views. It's, there's problems out there.
Well, of course, you know, abuse of power, you know, is the very essence of government. We had, at least at the federal level, restrictions placed on what the federal government could do. And, of course, really, the federal government has no justification at all for being involved in family matters or even being involved with individuals. If you read the 45th of the Federalist Papers, it says, you know, the power of the federal government is to be limited and defined, the power of the state and local government unlimited and ill-defined, and the power of the federal government was only to have to do with relationships with foreign countries and between states, but never with individuals. Where did we get away abandoning our Constitution and expanding the ability of the federal government to interfere in what happens in your family and my family?
Money. Money, 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 money. You know, it's very clear that federal policy, they can't go in there and tell you what to do. What they can do is first they take the money in the form of the income tax, and they say, okay, now if you want this money, we can't tell you what to do, but we can hold purse strings. If you want this money, this is what you'll have to do to get the money. And most people aren't aware, but Medicaid, Medicare, all those programs, everything from that to Child Protective Services to transportation to whatever it may be, they're purse strings like that. They can't tell you exactly what to do, but they can say if you want the money, then this is what you have to do. So catch 22. So the easy answer is if the states don't want to do that, then they just don't take the money. In some cases, it's a rather substantial amount of money, though. In the state of Utah, it will make up a very large percent of the overall funding. And there have been a number of areas where we have turned down the funding, and we'll either have to do it our own way and come up with our own funding or not do it at all. But most states are in a position in which a substantial, upwards of half of their entire state budget is made up of federal dollars.
You're talking now just on child protection or everything as a
everything.
Whole?
Most states, you will find that 30 to 50% of their entire state budget is made up of federal money one way or the other from all their different departments, so not just this.
And I think that the average individual really doesn't understand the danger that we have inherent in this system where the federal government is doing things it was never authorized to do under the Constitution. In fact, what the federal government can do is outlined in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And the 10th Amendment specifically said that all powers not specifically herein authorized to Congress or reserved to it by the states are to be reserved to the states and the people. It was to limit the power of the federal government. This is what our founding fathers feared, is that one day all power would go to Washington, D.C., and we would have a government as venal and authoritarian and restrictive as the government that they fought a revolution to get away from.
Yeah.
And it seems to be that that's the direction we're going today.
Yeah, we have big problems in that most people, the average Joe citizen out there, most of your, well, hopefully your listeners are better educated, but I know that as I talk to an awful lot of next-door neighbor type people, they just don't understand what's going on. They're very cynical about what's going on. If you try and coach them or ask them leading questions even about the balance of checks and balances in government, not just between the different branches of government, but between the federal government and the states, they'll give you generalized statements such as, we need to keep the federal government out, we need to run it ourselves, but then you ask them specifics and, you know, they get lost in a sea of ignorance. They just don't understand what's going on. And if you don't understand what's going on, it's awful difficult to make a good decision and ultimately rein in the federal government.
Well, don't you believe that one of the big problems is most Americans don't understand the Constitution. They don't understand the foundations of our freedom. They really don't understand what liberty is all about and where our liberty came from.
You know, we had a middle school group. So this is 6th and 7th graders, and this was four or five years ago. They did a big survey, and of course it's not professional and such, but it's actually, the questions were worded quite well. The short of it is they asked people, adults, they verified that they were registered to vote, and they asked them a simple question. The separation of church and state is found within which amendment to the Constitution? And if they were to ask questions about what's in the amendment to the Constitution, what's the first 10 amendments, the majority of them no doubt wouldn't understand it. But they had 80%+ of them guessing that it was in different amendments to the Constitution. They had less than 20% that said, well, it's actually not in the Constitution. So overwhelming majority, they just don't get it.
Well, don't feel bad. We have a local congressman here, and he was fighting against a well-educated lawyer, and they were both on a radio talk show. So the first question was to the lawyer, and he said, now, what article of the Constitution would you find a mention of the requirements of the judiciary? And of course, the lawyer who studied the Constitution said that's in the third article of the Constitution. And so then they turned to the congressman and he said, and how many articles are there in the Constitution? And he thought and he thought and he thought and he said, 28. And of course, he didn't know the difference between an amendment and an article. And the fact that we have people serving in Congress, this is a very well-educated man. He just doesn't understand the Constitution he's sworn to uphold. He wants to do what his gut feeling is. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we just provided things for everybody and we could, have the federal government regulate the environment and try to create utopia? And he doesn't understand that the things he's doing are in total violation of the Constitution that he's sworn to uphold. He's sworn to uphold a document. He doesn't even know the difference between an amendment and an article. This is why we're in trouble. But that would carry over into the general population. I don't think most members of our community understand, because they do not teach the Constitution in our schools. They do not teach the Constitution even in law school. And so many people I've met who are lawyers will attest to the fact that they have never once studied the Constitution. They read decisions, legal descriptions and discussions of the Constitution, but never the Constitution itself. How can you possibly uphold a document you don't understand?
Yeah, well, it's impossible. A few years ago, I don't remember the exact time frame, it was around the Republican Revolution in 94 when Newt Gingrich came into power. A House rule, so it wasn't in federal code, but a rule in the U.S. House of Representatives was that any appropriation had to come with it a clear, you had to say which article of the Constitution authorized that spending. Where in the Constitution do you get the authority to spend that on the executive or the judiciary or whatever it may be? And it just caused fits. And if I'm correct, it was only in place for 1 year. But boy, everybody was so quick to spend money, but then the next question is, okay, where in the Constitution is that authorized? And they'd always go to the general welfare statement, and, that's so absolutely entirely abused as far as the statement goes. And it just caused fits, enough so that they repealed that, and they no longer have that as a House rule.
Now, do you actually teach the Constitution, a required subject, back there in Utah at your high school?
You know, we have, the short answer is no. We do require some discussion. We will have some requirements for core curriculum for, like, the Bill of Rights and some discussion on the Constitution. But we have very broad statement, and as far as it being translated into good curriculum, it's not been all that effective. So we have some school districts that really go the distance and a number of them that really don't. In fact, we have some of them here. I've had a number of teachers say that, gosh, you know, we, we should just have these kids do the Pledge of Allegiance once a week, if that much. So it's a prevalent attitude nationwide.
Right, we have to have, you know, we can't take our time away from sex education in Marilyn Monroe, you know, to waste our time doing things like the Pledge of Allegiance.
Well, you've got a point there now, don't you?
Well, of course, we've got a long way away from this Child Abuse Protection Agency. What are the issues there, and why do you feel that this is so important, and what needs to be done?
Well, the real importance of this is obviously the family. You know, Hillary Clinton, she came up with that nice little book, It Takes a Village to Raise a Child, and I just could not disagree more. It doesn't take a village, it takes a family. And we're now getting past the 60s generation where everything was experimentation and whatever felt good is what we should do. And we can now clearly document something that I think the average reasonable person can understand, and it's the importance of the family. And we have had in the state of Utah, and I know a lot of states, and that's why I'm talking on radio programs nationwide, an attitude, an overexertion of government involved in the family. And it just needs to stop. We're learning that the best way that you can protect a child is in a good family situation. For those cases where there's some legitimate abuse or neglect going on, the answer is not to remove the child. The answer is to help, in whether it's going to religious, going to the family's clergy, their church, whatever it is, to strengthen the family. And that attitude is actually, it's good news. In the state of Utah, it's really taken hold. In a lot of states, it's really taking hold, a family preservation attitude. And where we butt into problems is with the federal government. The federal government, really well-intentioned, they stated in law that you can get some money the only way you can access the money is if you remove the child. And back in the days, four, five, 6 years ago, where the attitude is remove the child, it was great for those folks. They'd remove the child to get federal funding. Now there's a move afoot to preserve the family, but we still have the federal law saying, well, there's absolutely nothing that will be assisted from the federal government. And mind you, that can be a very significant portion of the state budget unless you remove the child.
No, what do they want you to do? Just put it into a foster family, or do they specify what happens to the child after it's been removed and the parental control and the parental respect has been destroyed?
Well, over, 90%+, unless there's a state that goes towards kinship or family placement like Utah has, it's got to be foster care situation. So they remove the child and they put it into a foster care situation.
But, you know, I hate to suggest that this is, I think most people think, well, they just don't know what they're doing. I think they know exactly what they're doing. I believe that there are wicked and evil people in government. We have a marriage tax where it costs you more income tax-wise if you're married than if you're not married. Now, what would that suggest to you? They're dumb, they're stupid, or they don't want people to get married. In other words, they actually tax you more if you get married. I think they know exactly what you're doing, and anything you do, you, of course, subsidize that which you want, and you penalize that which you don't want. And in this case, we're penalizing people for getting married. I think that some people are going to say, well, this is sort of a paranoid. No, I think you're only paranoid if you imagine people are against you or doing bad things intentionally. But, you know, to actually encourage breaking up a family, make that child realize that their parent now really isn't in control. Government is in control, and government can take them out of that family and take away the security that they have and the love. And, they're like most states, put them into a foster home, and you never know what's going to happen there. I think this is totally disruptive and destructive to the family, don't you think?
Well, and I agree. And as far as the cynicism, it was the state of Massachusetts. They went ahead and had a look at it, and they drew the conclusion that it was factual, that there were some mid-level managers that were making a decision, let's remove the child so that we can gain more federal funding. And so, absolutely, there are cases where that takes place. What I found, my own personal experience dealing with a lot of caseworkers, is that they'll go into a situation where there's something that's definitely gone on, and they want to work to improve the situation, but the only way they can have the funding to improve the situation is to remove the child. And under normal circumstances, they wouldn't remove the child, but the federal law is very clear. The only way they're going to get funding for, you know, whether it's counseling or health care or whatever it may be, is to remove the child. And so the federal government, I know in the state of Utah, we could easily chalk up, mind you, we're a state of only about 2.2 million people in population, so bear that in mind, but there's easily probably 500 to 1,000 children a year that are removed, that if we could just improve the family situation, they would never have to be removed. So the federal law is very clearly involved, complicit in the removal of upwards of 1,000 children a year.
So how much money do you get for disrupting the family and doing that?
Well, and this is where some folks get a little bit cynical, and they shouldn't. It's not as though the federal government will just write out a blank check. They actually max it out at $25,000, and it's not as though they write out a check for $25,000 and give it to the state. What they will do is open up an account in which the state could submit bills towards that will be reimbursed, and it will max out at $25,000 unless some extenuating circumstances take place, in which case it can go above that.
Well, you get what you subsidize, and if you subsidize taking children out of the house, you'll get them out of the house.
Absolutely, and that's a problem we're running into. And what we would like to work on, and what a few states have actually begun groundwork on, is doing in-home services, going into the family, seeing that they need some counseling, and saying, okay, well, have you talked to your minister? And heading that direction, what they found is besides all of the trauma, not only on the child but the family when they remove, they found that if they do in-home services, there's none of that trauma, and they are able to, for the same amount of money, they're able to help seven times as many situations. So it's far less expensive, far more efficient, and overall just incredible results.
Well, no, but what about the federal money? You don't get the federal money if you do that, do you?
Don't get the federal money, and that's the problem we run into. And so what we need to do and what I'm working on, a number of people are working on, is getting Washington to wake up and smell the coffee. Their policies are destroying families. There's just no two ways, there's no polite way of saying it.
Well, they're either terribly stupid or they know exactly what they're doing, and if it's the latter, then it truly is diabolical. So what can our listeners do to help you draw attention to this? Because sometimes the politicians, even if they don't want to, will respond when they feel enough heat. As somebody once said, politicians only see the light when they feel the heat.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth to that. What they need to do is call their congressman or their senator and say, and the catchphrase they need to remember is with Child Protective Services, they need to change the Title 4E to allow in-home services.
Title 4E to allow in-home services. Now, do you have any legislation for that?
Now, we're working on getting some amended. What will end up being is an amendment that will go into the overall Health and Human Services Appropriations budget. So it'll be a ways down the road. We're laying the groundwork now to hopefully this July through October get that in.
Now, do you have a congressman who will work with you and actually put that in as an amendment on some legislation?
You know, we have a couple of them, but I'm just not at liberty to,
all right,
to give their name until they actually say, yeah, and,
okay,
and off we go.
Well, I think that really, I think it was Will Rogers who said, no man's home or a property is safe when Congress is in session. And they are constantly passing legislation, and then they don't write the rules on this. Most of them don't even read the legislation. You know, who can be against helping children? It's sort of like, who can be against patriotism? Just vote for the USA Patriot Act. Certainly one of the most unpatriotic pieces of legislation ever written, but it had a great title, the USA Patriot, and I'm sure that these are child protection. I mean, who can be against a child protection? And yet, of course, what it's doing is child and family destruction. So you'd like people to write, to call their congressman and ask them to support changes in Title 4E that has to provide home services rather than taking children out of the homes?
Correct. And, you know, you mentioned federal laws dealing with, horrid laws dealing with great sound bites. No Child Left Behind. Another committee that I chair up at the Capitol deals with education. No Child Left Behind, in my opinion, will come to be known as the single greatest takeover of public education in the history of this country. There is no piece of legislation that has done more to tell the average parent, the average teacher, and principal to kind of park your brains in your back pocket, and Washington's going to drive this boat. It's just, it's amazing, all the mandates, all the hooks and catches in there. and it's got a great sales pitch, No Child Left Behind, but oh boy, it's causing fits. And it's only going to get worse is my concern with that one.
Well, I really believe you're absolutely right, and I think that these new federal regulations, as far as education is concerned, this whole idea of, we want to return control to the local community, we're just going to do testing to make sure that you're teaching the children correctly, and of course, most of these tests have nothing to do with academics, they have to do with feeling.
Well, the tests, there's a gentleman at the school district who's rather sophisticated, but actually comes from a farming background. He says, a pig doesn't get fat standing on the scale. And in the state of Utah, we will begin doing end-of-year testing in February. Of course, the end of the school year is in May and June. So it's causing us problems.
All right, fine. Now, of course, did you take the federal funds that you're going to have to do the federal testing?
Yeah, and that wasn't... Yeah, it passed by a small margin, but it passed.
Did the people have any idea what this was really all about? I think that probably most state legislators, just like most people, really have no idea what this is really all about. I mean, they put these things on the ballot here in California. I couldn't imagine people voting for almost $40 billion in new bond issues by the time they pay off the bonds and the interest on it. And they were sold the idea you can vote for these this bonds because it's not going to increase the taxes. But nobody ever told them where the money is going to come from. It's going to come from the general fund. Where does the general fund come from? From your taxes. They're going to have to increase taxes. They're fucks to provide for the general fund. But they were promised no new taxes. And the stupid people voted for almost $40 billion in bond issues and interest on those bonds over the next 40 years or 20 years. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Here in Utah, the problem we run with is that we are such an overwhelmingly Republican state. When the president, obviously Republican, puts down this No Child Left Behind, everybody's immediate instinct is, well, it's a Republican president, it's Republican legislation, therefore we've got to support it. And No Child Left Behind it's a small novel. It's over 600 pages, so it's just awful. And as everybody's sorting through it, everybody's saying, holy cow, this isn't what we want, it's not what we thought, and it's a little bit too late for that. But we have a very status quo attitude, and it takes an awful lot of smacking people on their head before their brain gets a signal and they start to reconsider what they're doing.
Well, they're good people in Utah, no question at all. But, of course, if you don't have access to the information, if you have to depend upon what you read in the newspaper and what most radio programs will tell you, you're in real trouble. And that's why I think what you're doing is so vitally important. In other words, going across America, getting onto radio and trying to let people understand what's really going on. And, of course, the people who listen to our programs, I think, are very, very well educated. We just need about 20 million more listeners and would really begin having a tremendous influence.
One thing I would caution your listeners, one little trap, is the grass is greener on the other side. And I've heard an awful lot that Utah is great, and, there are areas where we certainly excel at. But take new math. It's, the group math, where it's not so much whether you get the correct answer, it's how hard you try at it.
How you feel about it,
Yeah. You folks in the state of California, at least this is my understanding, and we've documented it, at least at a state level, you folks dumped this program a number of years ago. Well, gosh, here it is in Utah, and it's just now getting started. So in this area, you folks are a decade and a half ahead of us, and we're struggling to catch up. So we shouldn't get caught in the trap that Utah is perfect. We've got our problems. And in this area, Child Protective Services, we're doing some good things. We haven't necessarily cut the edge, but we sure have worked hard to make good policy stick.
Well, I think that you have good legislators and who understand the problems and take an intelligent approach. No problem is insurmountable, when enough good people get together.
Yeah. So long as they're sincere, we have our share of prima donnas, but so long as they're sincere and they want good policy, good things will happen.
All right.
I've always been of that opinion.
All right, well, we're going to have to take a break here for about 3 minutes, and when we get back, I will invite your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, and our guest, of course, is Matt Throckmorton, and he is, of course, a legislator in the state of Utah, and he heads the committee that deals with the Child Protection Agency.
And I'll take the time to teach the soul as well as mine. I'll teach this child how to care, continue on when I'm not there. Instill the values, life and time, to teach the soul as well as mine, with no child left behind.
Well, I mean, who could be against the No Child Left Behind? It certainly sounds great, but unfortunately, things are often not what they appear to be. And that was the song that George Bush used, No Child Left Behind. And we just happened to have it here, and I thought I'd play it for you. It sounds really great, but of course, it's like so often happens. Something looks good on the outside, but you've got to understand the real motivation behind it. Well, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there listening to us across America, we hope that many of you will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and partner with us in our effort to educate the American people about the foundations of our freedom, about the Constitution, about the various people and forces and organizations that are working there intent upon changing our way of life, creating a one-world society, creating a new world religion. And, of course, this would be the antithesis of everything America stood for. But, of course, you have to understand what America was in favor of and what America stood for before you can understand the significance of what is unfolding today and how wars are used to change society and, of course, to bankrupt society and to control the people. Not necessarily to defeat the enemy, but, of course, to change the society of the people who wage the wars. And so often happens, the people who were formerly our enemies now become our allies. The people who were formerly our allies now become our enemies. And we continue playing the games like musical chairs over and over again. And the great tragedy is, of course, in the end, why it is the young men who go off overseas to fight for freedom who find that they've lost freedom here at home. So if you believe there's a problem and you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And please don't forget our website. It's radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And, of course, you can listen to our programs either there or link to the other networks we're on, and so you can hear us 5 hours a day. And tell others about our website, tell others about our radio programs, and get them in the habit of listening. Hopefully we can get them hooked and begin to get them to understand the true nature of the battle in which we're engaged, because it's not the battle that they talk about on CBS, ABC, NBC, or on Fox Network. It's an entirely different battle. And then, of course, we would remind you once again about our conference that we're going to be holding on Saturday. It's a whole day long out at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course, and we hope that you'll want to come. But if you're going to come, you're going to have to let us know by tomorrow evening. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. There'll be a luncheon, a syllabus, there'll be some excellent speakers. We're going to talk about preparation for what lies ahead. Again, that's this Saturday, and give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. So we can, of course, know that you're coming, make preparations, and you'll have a lunch and a syllabus available. So we look forward to seeing you here this Saturday. Doors open at 8 o'clock, and we'll be going until 5 o'clock. Doors will be open till 6. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our guest is Matt Throckmorton, of course, who's in the state legislature in the state of Utah, and he's dealing with the child abuse problem, the Child Abuse Protection Agencies, and, of course, under Title 4E of the law, the federal statutes, why the local authorities are actually rewarded for taking children away from their parents. And, of course, they can get up to $25,000, on my understanding, for each child is taken away. And, of course, there are much more efficient means of dealing with the problems, as sometimes there are problems in a community, but taking the child away is the last thing in the world that you possibly would want to do. And so certainly Matt is trying to raise public awareness and getting people to write and email and fax and telephone their lawmakers. And what should they actually say, Matt?
Well, when they talk to them, they can even reference this radio show, but tell them that they are aware that in the Title IV-E contracts, which, you know, federal government has nice little terms for everything, the Title IV-E contracts right now require the states to remove a child before the federal government will allow money to assist the child in services. Tell them they need to assist in changing that law so that the federal government will allow in-home services. So Title IV-E needs to be changed to allow in-home services.
All right, fine. It just seems like a very, very worthy concept. And you were saying that if they can allow in-home services, they can do this for, what, about one-seventh of what it would cost to take that child out of the home?
One-seventh. And part of the changes that are coming about, in some cases it's not quite as economically efficient, and that's because the federal government requires such an administratively heavy burden on the system to check it all the way through, do diagnostics and such. And part of the changes will actually help it make it more efficient, more cost-efficient, more friendly to the family.
Well, it's sort of like what they've done in medicine. You know, I was a physician for many years, and, you know, it used to be, if you went to the hospital, you got a lot of personalized care and a back rub and a bath and all these things every day. And, well, no longer, oh, we've got to have nurses because we've got to have quality medical care. And then they got to fill out all this paperwork. And the nurses spend all their time doing paperwork and no time with the patients. And this is the problem we have every time you get the federal government involved. Why they'll have paperwork and they'll have changes and rules and regulations, and then they have new requirements as far as buildings is concerned, and they will regulate every aspect of everything, and they'll create so many problems and requirements and bureaucracies and inspectors that the whole system begins to implode. And that's what's happening in medicine. It is certainly happening in so many aspects of our society. And obviously, they're creating the same problems with, as far as filling out paperwork and child protection agencies.
They are. There is a heavy requirement from the federal government to double-check every penny. And the state of Utah, the federal government, their requirement actually kind of brought to our attention our requirement, the state requirement, and we've actually thinned that out an awful lot, and we'd like to see the federal government aspect thinned out a bit. The one thing that we found in this is that it's a simple matter of trust. It's trusting the individual to get the job done versus micromanagement, and we have Washington that loves to micromanagement. Most states like to love to micromanage, and boy, they require reports on everything, and everything has to be in triplicate, and they have to track every single thing that happens. When you really believe in local control and accountability for everything at the closest level to the citizen, micromanagement just doesn't work so well.
But, you know, local control is so much more efficient. It's so much more economical. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when we didn't have any Medicaid and we didn't have any Medicare. And, of course, everybody got health care. There was no problem. Yes, certainly you had county hospital care, but at least in the county hospital you got a back rub. Try to go to a private hospital a day and get a back rub. You know, and, of course, admittedly, you know, if somebody had a home and they were elderly and they didn't have any money, why, the county put a lien on their home, and, of course, when they could live there as long as they wanted to. When they died, why, the county sold the home to pay off their medical bills. Nothing wrong at all with that. And of course, what we're doing now is, you know, everything is free, but it becomes increasingly difficult to get it. Certainly, we have still an excellent medical system, but look at what the socialized medical system has done up in Canada, where people have to come to the United States to get medical care. And in England, where they've actually gone away from their socialized medical system, increasingly back to a private system. But whenever the government gets involved with anything, it eventually complicates it and destroys it. And I really fear that this is exactly what they're doing with a child prevention agency is a good idea starting out with, but once all these rules and regulations come in, why it becomes increasingly cumbersome, and now it's becoming harmful because, of course, what we're doing is encouraging the child abuse protection agencies to intervene and take that child away from their parent. And what are the, have you ever looked into the psychological impact of taking those children out of the home, Matt?
Oh, it's awful. And a lot of these folks, they admit it readily. They'll admit and acknowledge the impact it'll have, mostly on the children, but certainly the family. There was a case where I dealt with a Baptist minister, an impeccable record, no speeding tickets, I mean, just very clean. He had a 13-year-old daughter who mouthed off to him, said something entirely inappropriate. He smacked her. There was a little bit of a red mark, but within an hour or so, it was gone. Obviously, no welt, no bruise, but it was abuse. So the child didn't come home from school that day. It took about 3.5-4 months to get that child home, and I was involved with that. Got to know the family pretty well. 7-8 months after the child was returned, I ran into that father, and he said, you know, there's not been a single morning yet. We're waiting for the morning when we wake up that our daughter, who's now 14, won't be either at the foot of our bed or have climbed into bed with us out of absolute fear that the state's going to come take her. And, of course, the state didn't come into the home to remove her. They took her from school, but just scared to death, petrified that she'll be removed again. There's a very dramatic impact on a lot of these kids.
But I know what the impact can be. I had a friend of mine whose daughter was mouthed off, and he just took and shook her. Well, she reported to the child abuse people, and, of course, they came and threatened to take the child out of the home, you know, if they ever try to discipline her again. And, of course, the family had to go to counseling because the father had shaken the girl for being a nasty brat, which is she probably should have been turned over his knee and paddled. And this girl went from bad to worse. You know, the next thing, she was off with illicit sexual activity, off on drugs. She got pregnant, you know, and, you know, at 13 or 14 years old, a direct result, you know, of limiting the ability of parents to discipline children. And if you cannot discipline a child, many times these children are going to have terrible, terrible problems. God gave the children to the parents, and it is parents' responsibility to discipline them. And, you know, if we all will do that somewhat differently. Nobody wants a child beaten, but sometimes they need a good paddling or a good slap.
You know, and a number of these children, and I wouldn't even dare guess to say what percentage it would be as a whole, but a number of them, they are problem children, and they're manipulative. And what I've seen and what a lot of folks acknowledge is that once they recognize the power they have by simply saying, well, if you do this, I'm going to call DCFS, and I'm going to get you turned in for a neglect or abuse or whatever it may be, the relationship, the ability to even reason with a child is just completely out the window. It's not even a matter of discipline, but to have a decent discussion and explain to the child consequences of their actions, well, they pretty much have to go to the counselor. Because if they do anything else, then it's emotional abuse, and they're browbeating their kids, and the children learn this, especially the teenagers. They learn it, and they abuse it. It causes fits.
So, I mean, really, in the effort to help the children, and, of course, not only through the local community, but then, of course, through the state and then the federal, we've created a monster. We've created a situation where we have children with no discipline at all. And then we wonder why we have the number of pregnancies, why we have the number of violence. We have children killing children and children killing their parents. And it's almost like we've raised a society with no conscience at all. And I can't believe this has happened accidentally.
Well, I don't know, you know, accidentally or otherwise. It's just obviously happened, and it's got to change.
The end result is exactly the same, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And, of course, we've got to get people, you know, to return responsibility to the local community. And if the federal government were taking so much money from us, why the local community would have more?
The federal government. In the state of Utah, and actually you folks in California have a great big problem with this. We can go back to the subject of education funding. If you look at the funding property tax issues relative to the amount of property in a state that's controlled by either the state or by the citizens, private control. You get west of the Mississippi, and the state of Utah, depending on what you count, upwards of 80% of the state of Utah is owned or controlled by the federal government.
Why don't you tax them? No, I'm just joking. But
you know, if I were governor, we'd have some fun in the state of Utah. But it's a dramatic impact to the tunes of hundreds of millions of dollars. And again, in California, that's no big deal. Hundreds of millions of dollars in the state of Utah, that can be 15 to 30% of our state budget.
Sure.
And it's that much loss of control. And that's just the monetary aspect of it. The federal government, you know, they're just, you know, what can you say? It's the federal government.
Well, I think that the federal government is supposed to be our servant, not our master. And if the federal government was abiding by the terms of the contract, and that is the Constitution, that was to take the chains off of the people and put the chains on the government, for that government governs best, it governs the least. If American people understood what's happening and simply kept voting congressmen out of office who wouldn't do what's right, you know, the trouble we have is we get the congressmen back there, and they get so accustomed to the power and the prestige, they're not dedicated to the right or left, they're just dedicated to staying in Washington, D.C. And until they understand that they're going to get voted out if they don't do what's right, whether Republicans or Democrats, whether they're pro-life or anti-life, it really doesn't matter. The important thing to do is they have to stand up for the Constitution and for their constituents, rather than for the power brokers back in Washington, D.C. And, you know, as soon as you get back to Washington, D.C. as a young congressman, they tell you how smart you are and, boy, how lucky their constituents are, and they take them off for training. And pretty soon they actually begin to believe what they've been taught. And really, of course, you get money for re-election from the Republican or the Democratic National Committee. And who do you really represent? Do you represent the constituents, or do you represent the power elite that really runs Washington, D.C.?
You know, we have some outstanding members of Congress, House and Senate back there. They're few and far between. We have a lot of really mediocre, and both parties, both sides of the aisle. And then we have a number of folks that you just wouldn't trust a dollar bill with. And they're very comfortable with being very popular and powerful and such, and it's frustrating. We take our issues here in Utah, land issues. In the West, in Utah, I guess in a lot of ways we're still back in the cowboy way of doing things. There's an old saying in Utah, three things you don't mess with. You don't mess with a man's land, his wife, or his water. And the joke goes, you can even flirt with his wife, but don't mess with his land or water. And trying to deal with Washington on land and water issues is just absolutely horrendous. And then trying to get even our congressmen in Utah, trying to get their attention on some of these issues can be very frustrating. There's an issue that took place with water. A couple of counties have been promised a compact with the federal government. They've been promised water delivery for going on 5 decades now. They've paid property taxes on that forever. For that 5 decades, and the congressman who represents him, he got in a really tough campaign, and he wanted to keep another part of his district happy, went and changed the federal law, overwhelming support in Washington. Their water rights are shot forever, just completely gone for the sake of one congressman's reelection. Just
horrendous. Well, I hope that he won't be reelected again.
Well, we're going to work on it, and in the year 2004, we're going to send him one of those Kodak cameras and tell him to take pictures, because if all goes well, he'll be done.
And I think this is really what you have to do. People have to do what's right rather than what's expedient. And, you know, of course, you can't doing what's right. In fact, you had one congressman back there, you know, who was a Republican, and I've even forgotten his name, but he was defeated in the primary, you know, because he wouldn't go along with the free trade programs. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Is it Bob Barr from Georgia you're talking
about? No, I'm telling you, he was a Utah congressman. We had him on.
Oh, Merrill Cook.
Merrill Cook, right. What a nice man. What a courageous man who refused to, I've forgotten whether it was the World Trade Organization or the Fast Track legislation, but it was one of those. And he felt it was a betrayal of his responsibility. And he was offered, you know, I don't know, $500,000 for his reelection campaign or $1 million or something if he'd just sell his vote. He wouldn't do it. and they defeated him in the primary. The party, a Republican party, defeated him in the primary because he wouldn't certainly bow to their power structure and go along with their programs, which are destroying the infrastructure of our nation and our industrial base.
Yeah, and, you know, as a pretty involved in the state Republican Party, I can attest to what Merrill had to say. They went after him hard. Now, I don't know about an offer for, you know, help him fundraise for $500,000 or $1 million.
This is what he told me on the radio. We have his interview.
Yeah, they went after him viciously. And this congressman that I'm referring to that gave up the water rights for his reelection, he was one of them who really stepped forward and went after Merrill. And Merrill, you know, one problem with Merrill, I suppose, is he's not this big, fancy, schmoozing politician, but just a great congressman. He really understood the balance of government, and he was willing to very politely. He didn't grandstand issues. He didn't chain himself to any doors. He would simply vote right. And ultimately, when you're elected and sent to either the state capital or the nation's capital, you're not elected to be popular or to schmooze or to go to basketball games or whatever. You're elected to vote, and everything boils down to how you vote. And he voted quite well.
Yeah, I'm sure he did. And I looked up his voting record, and I was very. And I was just so taken aback that they would take him out in the primary. You know, the Republican Party ran somebody against the incumbent, as they did, of course, against Bob Smith back in New Hampshire, a punishment because he wouldn't go along with the power structure. And until people understand that and the people are willing to get involved in the electoral process, I don't like politics. I don't like the electoral process. But, you know, it's the only system we have to work with. And we're losing America because half the people aren't even registered. And in many of the elections, half the people who are registered don't bother to vote. And then we wonder why we're losing our freedom.
Well, and a lot of those people, it's a struggle that individuals who are pretty involved with the process have. All those people who don't even register, or worse yet, they register and don't vote. There's an awful lot of cynicism out there. Does their vote even count? And quite honestly, there are plenty of occasions where you have candidate Tweedledee and candidate Tweedledum, and what does it matter?
Well, I'll tell you what, we had a vote election here for state senate, right in a county right next to us, and I think there's, you know, out of probably 170,000 votes, you know, they're 1,000 votes apart, and those votes really do make a difference.
They do.
And the good guy is ahead, at least by the present time, and you know, you know, I'm just as pleased as I can be that I hope that he will be able to, you know, they still haven't certified the election. And I just keep waiting for the Democrats to suddenly find the three boxes of votes, all people who died many years ago, but now they have their votes and they voted for the Democrat candidate. Because traditionally the Democrats will cheat because they don't have, many of them, and I say this, a generalization, but they don't have a moral compass. Whereas most Republicans will not cheat. That's not universal. But, of course, I think that's not a bad generalization. We've got a lot of good Democrats. We've got a few bad Republicans. But anyway, let's not get off into that. I don't even know whether you're a Republican or Democrat.
I'm a Republican.
All right, fine. Well, the important thing is that for our plea is for you to get involved out there. And certainly you can call and write and fax and your congressman, probably better not to write right now because I think they're still checking the mail for anthrax, but you can certainly email and fax and call and tell them, you know, that Title 4E has got to be modified and changed so that we can get away with the federal requirement which encourages, or the federal legislation which encourages taking children out of the home.
And actually, just to clarify, it doesn't encourage, it states the only way you'll get the money is if the child has been removed. So it flat out, very clear, you have to remove in order to get that money. We want to go to a system where the federal money is contingent upon providing in-home services with a cap, so that instead of removing the child to help it out, you can help the child and leave it with the family, which is almost always the best circumstance for it.
And, you know, what really bothers me, as you pointed out earlier, is the what happens to the parent-child relationship when the child realizes that they can begin to manipulate their parent, you know, and undermine their authority. And if once you undermine the authority in the home from the parent to the child, it's sort of like an army. And what happens when the soldiers won't take orders from the commanders? Why you lose the battle? And that's what's very, very clearly. There's no way a military organization or even a business operation can work if every one of the employees is going to determine what they're going to do and not follow orders. And it goes right back to the home. And when that child is not subservient to the parents, you end up with a chaotic relationship. And we see the breakdown of the family, and that's exactly what's happening all across America today. Well, did you have any parting thoughts for our listeners today?
Well, I would encourage them to get involved. And I imagine an awful lot of them are on the road, long night driving, whatever it may be the case. They need to just keep in mind the simple little things. They need to call their congressman or their U.S. senator and say that they need to assist changing the Title IV-E law so that they can do in-home services. And a very proactive, at this point, there's no use beating up on the federal government. I suppose we've taken our pot shots at them. They can be very frustrating. But at this point, we're going to be very proactive, and we are going to improve the system. And that's how we're going to improve it, is by allowing in-home services.
All right, Joe, don't tell them what you think of them. Tell them that here's something that's very, very positive and something that needs to be done, and you would appreciate their support. They may not even have heard of this at all, but if they get three or four or five or a dozen calls, they're going to begin looking into this and finding out what the problems really are. I dare say that there's probably not one, in 50 congressmen who really understands the implications of these laws, you think?
Most know. They really don't. Even my congressman, he doesn't understand them at all. So the importance of your callers actually making the call, they'll get a staffer and they may say, well, we'll have to look into that because we haven't heard of it. But eventually they will be talked to, and it'll be something that, I got a call on that a couple of months ago. Your listener's phone call will have an impact. It will improve the system.
As long as they know what people are concerned about out there, they want to be the leaders, but they got to have the people behind them so that they're going to be out in the lead. Well, I want to thank you really for what you're doing and taking the time to go on radio programs and I'm sure go over these same issues over and over again. But, this is what it takes to begin to build that groundswell of support for an idea, and I hope this is an idea that's time has come.
Well, I do too, and I appreciate you letting me come on your show.
Well, God bless you, and thanks very much. Anytime you want to come on, you have my number, and would love to put you on this or some other subject.
Well, I appreciate that, and we'll keep that in mind.
Good night. God bless you. Bye-bye.
All right.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. That was Matt Throckmorton, and, of course, he's there on the front lines of the battle in the state legislature, and those of you out there ought to think about running for political office. You don't want to do it. I don't blame you for not wanting to do it. But if you don't, the wicked people will. And freedom is lost when good people are not involved. And so I would encourage you to give serious thought to becoming involved in this epic struggle. And you can do it any sort of ways. My forte is not in politics. My forte is behind a microphone trying to educate people. Other people can do it by writing. Other people can do it by getting onto other people's talk radio programs or running for political office or simply telling others people about what's going on and helping to educate them. Help us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure. And remember those words of Thomas Jefferson, God who gave us life gave us liberty. But can the liberty of a nation be secure when the conviction has been forgotten that liberty is the gift of God? I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, and his justice cannot sleep forever. And that is true. God will bring justice on this country if we don't turn back to him and we continue doing what we're doing. And so please remember to pray for our country and pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow, at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Dr. Stan, get the computer turned off. Everything, lights are off, computer's turned off. I guess you don't lock the door, though.
Paper? No. Barbara, take care of that. So appreciate so much your coming over and doing that. That's the best stuff.
What I call God's sense of humor. I've been meaning to call and offer something for